Good morning. Welcome to our Asthma Grand Rounds program, and welcome to our colleagues at Mass General and North Shore and Lake Clinic who join us by video conferencing. I thought I'd take just 1 minute before introducing our speaker this morning to share with you next year's Asthma Grand Rounds series. I think you'll agree it looks like a tremendous series of presentations beginning in September with a roundtable discussion of a clinical controversy about what should the next expert panel of the National Asthma Education and Prevention Program recommend as step 3 therapy for moderate asthma. We've invited Suzanne Hurd to join us from her work at the NIH and in GINA to tell us the story of developing the GINA guidelines from an insider. Dr. Gaston, a pediatric pulmonologist now at the University of Virginia, will come and talk to us about severe asthma in children and adults. Josh Boyce will lead a panel discussion about food allergies. And Dr. Les Kobsek, a pathologist here at the Brigham, will talk to us about what histopathology can teach us about asthma. So another series of wonderful presentations coming next year. And today, I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Benjamin Raby, who's a leading investigator in the respiratory genetics group at Channing Laboratories, a member of our pulmonary and critical care division at the Brigham Women's Hospital. And we're delighted to have him to talk to us today about asthma genomics. And what have we learned so far? Dr. Raby.
So what have we learned so far about asthma genomics? A little disclosure slide. And then to say that what I'd like to do in the next 45 minutes or so is to describe where we've been over the past 10 years in the development of asthma genetics and asthma genomics as a science, and where we're going, where we are, and then where we're going. And I'm going to focus most of the discussion, in fact, all of it, on the genetic aspect of genomics, going from single polymorphism to genome-wide studies, and will not be able, due to time, to really speak about microarray and other types of genomic approaches that are being used more and more frequently in the dissection of asthma. So just as an introduction, I don't think I have to convince most clinicians that there seems to be a fairly important, though not total, genetic component to the pathobiology of asthma. The epidemiologic literature, both with respect to relative risk, estimates of the total variation due to asthma, as well as modifications of various aspects of the natural history of asthma, have all been linked through very large, well-characterized studies. And it's very clear now that a good proportion of the liability for the development of asthma is genetic in nature. Estimates vary depending on the quality of the studies and the ascertainments of the populations, but one could say reasonably that 30 to 50% of the variability in the trait is caused by genetics and with strong interaction with the environmental factors. So the question becomes, why should we study genetics? And I think that there are two fundamental reasons. And they work in concert and parallel, but they're somewhat distinct. On the one hand, we want to motivate understanding the underlying pathobiology of the disease. By identifying the variants that underline the disease process, we can then identify which genes are affected by those variants and have a better understanding of the molecular pathology underlying asthma, allergy, and so on. But in addition to that, a promise of the genome era has been that we can use the variants that we identify to classify subjects, to predict their natural history, and hopefully to tailor their medications in a personalized way. So these are mutually inclusive. There's a lot of complementary studies that are done from what we determine from one set of studies to the next. But as you'll see, I think there's been a lot of progress in one area and not so much as of yet in the other. So it's very important to understand when we talk about genetics that we're no longer talking about monogenic disease when we're talking about asthma, but rather a polygenic complex disease, where you have, instead of one gene, one dominant gene, in this case CFTR, causing cystic fibrosis, where the penetrance, the manifestation of the disease, is modified somewhat by environmental factors or by other gene modifiers. In asthma and in other common diseases, we see many genes of varying effect, some with a more dominant effect and some with a very weak effect, interacting directly on the trait with each other, and of course in the context of a lot of environmental factors to develop the disease. And so the strategies that are used to map the genes that underline complex traits are different from the ones that were used initially for monogenic traits. And as you'll see, it's not so easy to map these genes. So what do we mean by mapping a gene? Very often people use the analogy that it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. I think that there's a much more apt analogy, and that is looking for a misspelled word in an encyclopedia. So if we think of the encyclopedia of 23 volumes of chromosomes, each chromosome would represent one book. Within that book are many chapters, and those could be considered the cytologic bands, so regions of the genome that span between 10 and 30 megabases of DNA. We could then get down to, within a specific chapter, a page or a few pages, and those could be considered the haplotype block, so a range of the genome that has a conserved set of haplotypes, of combination of variants, and segregate in the population as distinct structures. And then we can get down to the actual paragraph, potentially the gene, and within that, look for the misspelled spring of hope, the sprung of hope. The theme I'd like to get across by the end of the lecture is that the resolution with which we're able to map these genes has been increasing readily over time, such that when we began studying complex traits in earnest in the early 1990s and really in the late 1990s, we were really saddled with using fairly crude linkage approaches, which I'll describe, that really only got us down to the resolution of potentially the book, the chromosome, or a large chromosomal segment. And today, we really are at the level of the base pair. So let's take a trip back in time. We'll start with the linkage era. And so if we think back to the late 1990s and the early 2000s, there were some good things about that time, and then there were some bad things about that time. So just to say, in terms of progress, we'll track progress with respect to how well the Boston teams did and the size of cell phones. We won't talk about progress necessarily in terms of politics or music, but you get the idea. So first I'll begin with candidate gene studies, which really did predate linkage and kind of go against a little bit what I'm talking about, this resolution. But what is a candidate gene study? Well, this is a type of study where instead of looking through the whole genome or using an agnostic approach where we don't have an idea of what the underlying biology might be, we take our favorite genes, so my favorite gene, and we take the specific pages or chapters that we think might harbor the polymorphisms. And we might sequence through those genes to look for variation, and when we find those variants, genotype them in a bunch of people who have the disease, cases, and a bunch of people who don't have the disease, controls. We might expect in these types of association studies that variants that cause the disease would be more frequently seen in the cases than in the controls. And this is the basis of most association studies. There are other types of association studies called family-based studies, which use family-based data, parents and children or affected siblings. But for the sake of simplicity, we'll talk really in the context of association. So there were a large number of association studies performed in the early 21st century, because they're relatively easy to do. You have a gene of interest, you do some sequencing to find the variants you're looking for, and then you specifically type those. And so there have been more than 1,000 such association studies done with different genes. And this is a summary dating back to 2006, showing for the number of times a gene replicated in multiple cohorts, how many genes with asthma were identified. So the majority of associations showed replication in fewer than 6 cohorts, where a handful of genes, let's say a total here of about 22, showed 6 or more showed association in six or more populations. And one might think that when we see associations in that many different independent populations, that there must be something to these genes. That's not to say that the ones that fall into these categories aren't important, but the lack of consistent reproducibility makes it a little bit less likely. What I would say about this, although it looks maybe somewhat impressive, is that you really have to wonder if the glass is half full, in that we do have a set by the year 2006 of replicated, validated asthma susceptibility genes, or is the glass really half empty? And there's a few reasons why it might be considered half empty. One is, because it's a candidate gene study, you already have an intuition that this gene is important. And so the only thing you're really adding to our understanding from this study is that there's a genetic variability and a genetic basis to the involvement of that gene. But a biological candidate can have really important functional implication without really having any genetic variation that influences the disease. So really, from a lot of these studies, we don't gain really any new insights into the underlying pathogenesis of the disease. What's not shown in this graph is the fact that there were far more failures, genes that were tested that didn't associate, and many studies done that really were negative, never published. And finally, this list is quite generous in terms of what was considered a replication. And I think that if we used very stringent criteria of saying that a gene had to have the same variant in the same direction causing the same type of genetic effect, this list would be much, much smaller, maybe down to two or three genes. So this early era was somewhat pleasant, but not as good as it could have been. So then we get in to the era of linkage analysis and positional cloning. Things start looking up in a number of different ways. Again, I will be focusing mostly on this side of the screen. Phones got smaller, Red Sox and Patriots started doing better, and we started seeing some really interesting findings from linkage studies. So linkage studies represented the first truly agnostic, hypothesis-free approach to mapping genetic variants. And really, the major appeal of genetic studies is that you can use the way genes segregate in families to map genes that are associated with disease without knowing anything about the pathobiology. You don't need candidate genes. So how does this work? Suppose we have a family here with affected individuals, noted in green, and unaffected individuals in white. If we presume for this model here that you need one variant, one copy of it, the big D, to cause disease, we could make up a fictitious genotype of big D for little d for every person who has the disease. We then genotype markers across the genome and look for those markers that show a very tight correlation between the genotype of the disease and the genotype of the marker. And so here we see an example of perfect correlation. In this one family, it could be totally due to chance, but if you saw something similar in multiple families, you'd have strong evidence for linkage. And then you would look around the genome in that region to see what genes are there and what might harbor variants. So between 2002 and 2005, a number of genome-wide linkage studies were performed in asthma, and this table summarizes the results. Now, they were somewhat successful. Some of them identified some really interesting genes and regions, but in many cases, there was moderate evidence of replication. The strength of the associations linkage was not very high, and there wasn't a ton of compelling evidence. So the next thing that people went on to do was to do positional cloning within these regions. That is to say, they genotyped a dense set of markers within these linked regions that are identified that might be 10 megabases or 20 megabases in size, and do association testing, going back to the candidate gene approach, around each of those genes. And here are two examples where an initial linkage peak, so this shows the significance as represented by log score versus the chromosomal distance across a chromosome. We see a very strong log score for asthma and airways responsiveness in a study published by Van Ardaway back in 2002. And fine mapping across all of the genes in this region identified a very strong signal of association specifically for polymorphisms in the gene ADAM33. and this was the first positionally cloned asthma gene. Similarly, in a study that was published 2 years later, a similar hierarchical mapping with additional markers being laid down within these linked regions finally led to the identification of GPR154 as the second positionally cloned asthma gene. And this gene in particular represents one of the most replicated genes in the asthma literature. So again, there have been some successes with this approach, and we see here a number of positionally cloned genes that were identified over this period. And what's most important about this slide is two things. One is that if you look at the names of these genes, any of you who were familiar with pathobiology of asthma prior to these studies being published would not have really thought of any of them, with potentially the exception of one of the HLA genes. So this really illustrates the novelty and the importance of moving forward with genetic-based approaches, that we can identify novel genes that would never have otherwise been suspected. The other important thing to note is that with respect to replication, the ability to see these findings in other populations, despite these, you know, very sophisticated studies, many of these genes have not panned out in a large number of cohorts. And so it remains unclear for many of them whether or not they're truly important. And so this, too, was a little bit discouraging. But the question really is why don't these studies replicate? And the answer is manifold. So the initial study could be wrong for a number of reasons, or the follow-up study could be wrong. Yet likely, very often, follow-up studies, those studies are underpowered. There's something very different about those populations that make it difficult to do proper association. But interestingly, it can be in some cases that without really robust replication, both studies are still true. And that could be due to the complexity of the disease, what I was showing you earlier with the multiple genes interacting with each other. You can have different genes in different cohorts interacting in different ways to cause the disease, for one example. Environmental exposures might be very different between the two. But nonetheless, even though we have these excuses, it was still somewhat discouraging that we weren't making the type of progress that we really wanted to see. Having said that, in 2007, this is what the landscape of the asthma genetics field looked like. This is a diagram plotting the spatial representation of where genes fall out in the cell, from the nucleus through to the cytoplasm, the cell membrane, and then the extracellular space. And then there's divisions based on different processes. And this is a slide taken from a review paper by Johan Basse and Tom Hudson. And it illustrates all of the genes that had been replicated in at least one population. So again, a fairly liberal view of what the architecture of asthma looked like. And highlighted in green are the genes that were identified by positional cloning. So despite some of my disparaging remarks about association studies, about candidate gene studies, they dominate this figure. And interestingly, there are a number of genes that are important potential therapeutic targets as FDA-approved drugs that target these genes had been identified. So I think that going back to this point in time, there was some optimism, but there was still a lot of disappointment with respect to identifying novel genes. Well, then we get into the good years. And that begins in 2006. And so you can see that the phones are getting smaller and the championships are continuing to pile up here in Boston. And we get into the era of the genome-wide association study. So what is a genome-wide association study? I explained to you earlier what a candidate gene association study is, where we test variants in a case-control population. Genome-wide studies are essentially the same thing, but instead of genotyping one polymorphism or a few polymorphisms at a time, we genotype thousands, hundreds of thousands, in some cases over a million polymorphisms, using DNA microarrays. We take that genotype data from the entire cohort, and for each SNP, perform an association test, just like we would for a candidate gene. We can then plot those results in what's typically referred to as a Manhattan plot, because we're looking for the skyline of Manhattan with some skyscrapers, where we see the physical position of each polymorphism tested plotted against the statistical significance, usually as the negative log p-value. And so here's an example from the first GWAS study in asthma, which showed a very significant association for polymorphisms on chromosome 17q. And this was the first asthma association genome-wide study published. And it turns out that this region has now been replicated literally dozens and dozens of times in different populations and represents a true bona fide asthma susceptibility gene. One thing that I'll point out that is different between genome-wide studies and candidate gene studies is that, unlike in candidate gene studies, where you can use a relatively liberal statistical threshold, here I've outlined what a 0.05 might look like, we need to ramp up that threshold very severely to account for all of the multiple comparisons that are performed. So in the studies that I'm going to be showing you moving forward, we're really talking about variants that have very, very strong associations in the populations that are tested. Okay, so one of the major advantages of GWAS studies, and the reason why they've taken hold so nicely, is not only is there potentially increased statistical power, and they're also easier to do than collecting families, but the resolution is very different, as I was alluding to earlier. So with linkage analysis, you really only get down to the cytologic band, okay, or the book chapter. And then you need to do additional positional cloning to get down to the haplotype block. Even with that, you don't usually get down to the variant, the disease variant itself. You have to do further work after that. Gene-wide association studies basically get you to exactly the same point as you would after the positional cloning. So down to the level of a haplotype block or two, and a handful of genes usually to have to follow up at that point. So here again is the plot from that original GWAS study, and we see that the polymorphisms that were most strongly associated on chromosome 17 have a frequency of about 40% in the population, so that's quite common. And they conferred fairly modest odds ratios of 1.1 to 1.5, but given how frequent they are in the population, that's a relatively impressive population attributable risk. And it explains the fact that you have this combination of a very high frequency and a pretty good odds ratio that the gene replicates so many times. It's really a quite an important gene, it appears. Now, what's interesting is recent studies have suggested that this gene might only be important in childhood asthma, and particularly in those cases that are associated without atopy. Others have disputed that. We've seen very strong association of this gene in allergic cohorts, but more needs to be done before we know that for sure. But it does speak to the importance of understanding your phenotype and understanding that there might be differences in the genetic background of different types of asthma, depending on the phenotypic presentation of the disease. The gene also appears to be associated with severity markers as well. Not only do we know what the locus is, do we know what the polymorphisms are, but we now have a very good understanding of what these variants do. So it turns out that the associated variants in this region have a regulatory effect. They don't change the structure of the gene, but instead they alter the ability of transcription factors to bind to the promoter region of the gene or nearby, and result in a genotype-dependent difference in the expression of one of the neighboring genes, in fact, two. So here we see the relative expression of one gene, ORMDL3. There's another gene, Gasdermin B, that shows a very similar pattern. And we see that as we go from normal genotype to the risk genotype, the expression of ORMDL3 decreases. This variant and several others sit on a unique haplotype, and that haplotype shows extremely strong association with asthma in essentially every cohort that's been tested. Interestingly, there's another haplotype here that shows a very strong association with Crohn's disease, but not with asthma, suggesting that there might be an overlap in some of the underlying pathobiology. Well, it turns out that this one of these variants that sits on this haplotype differentially binds a regulator called CTCF. It's an insulator protein. And by differentially binding, depending on whether you have the G allele or the pathogenic C allele, you see a difference in expression of four genes that sit right there in that region. The most important two are ORMDL3 and Gasdermin. And so we see that with the C polymorphism, you see increasing expression of those genes. So I misspoke before on the earlier slide. This is the pathogenic variant, and you see an increased expression. So From this, we have the genetics, we have some of the functional work, and what remains to be seen here is which one of these genes that are equally regulated by these susceptibility variants, which one of these genes is truly the one that causes the disease. And it may very well be that both have a role to play. So other GWAS studies have been performed, and these vary in their size, ranging from fairly substantial of 2 to 9,000 to some much smaller studies. And what you can see is that there's a very strong correlation between the size of the sample, the number of genes identified, and whether or not there's evidence of replication. In fact, you can see that for some of the smallest study, there were no genes that met genome-wide significance. I've shaded in gray here two studies where no gene met genome-wide significance, but several came extremely close, and they had very modest internal replication. But for the most part, the studies that have really replicated are those where you had a large sample size and a very clean phenotype. One of the big issues has been sample size. And in the very recent past, there was a nice move towards forming large consortia to pool data and to conduct very large-scale GWAS studies. And so here are two that are either have been published, the Gabriel study, and are another that is currently in press, that looked at a far larger number of subjects. In the case of Gabriel, they looked at 26,000 subjects from essentially across Europe, several sites in Canada, and Australia and New Zealand. All of the subjects were Caucasian. It was a case-control study. The EVE consortium is a meta-analysis, actually, of several GWAS studies that were performed, all of which were in North America at 18 different centers across the United States. Although the sample size is considerably smaller, it's actually even smaller than that in some sense, because these studies include Caucasians, African Americans, and Latinos, and so the meta-analyses were first done individually in each of these ethnic groups, and then results from that pulled together. I would say as well that although it's a smaller cohort, the fact that there are these different ethnic groups actually gave us some really interesting insights that can't be gained from the European data alone. So these are the Manhattan plots from the two studies. So the Gabriel study, which was published in New England Journal of Medicine last year, you can see here that in contrast to the earlier Manhattan plot that I showed you, there's a lot more skyscrapers that meet genome-wide significance, and this bespeaks to the sample size. And again, if you were to look at some of the genes that come up on this slide, some of them actually are interesting asthma candidates to begin with, and others are quite novel. If we look at the four panels from the EVE consortium, we see in the combined analysis multiple genes that met genome-wide significance. But what's interesting is that in each of the individual cohorts, there are very distinct patterns. And we find that there are some genes that are present only in the Latino populations and others that are present only in the African-American populations that don't appear in the European-American populations. Again, suggesting that ethnic-specific variants might be very important in the underlying pathogenesis of the disease and is reminiscent of the fact that there is a very striking difference in severity and prevalence of asthma depending on ethnicity. So those Manhattan plots are very nice, but I think this table really illustrates the real excitement that we now have in the world of asthma genomics. And I would say if there's any slide that you take home from the lecture today, it's this one. So presented here are the results from the Gabriel study of the top genes that were identified. And next to that, the results from the EVE study. In the Gabriel study, there were several more genes that met significance than in the EVE study, and that again bespeaks to the larger sample size. But quite incredibly, the top genes that came out in the Gabriel study were also the most significant genes in the EVE study. And so we now have very, very strong evidence that these genes are important in asthma in European populations. Interestingly, one of the genes that met genome-wide significance in the EVE study, this FIN1 gene, was only associated with asthma in the African-American cohort. It was not associated in the European cohorts or in Gabriel, which was all European, so Caucasian-American and the European cohorts, because this variant, the susceptibility variant, isn't present in Caucasian populations. It is in Latino populations, but as you'll see on the next slide, it's not. It doesn't seem to be associated with asthma in Latinos. If we go then further down the list of the associated genes in the Gabriel cohort, three of them show trends of association in the Eve population as well, suggesting that in total we have about six or seven genes that replicate consistently across populations. And this is far different from what we were seeing in the earlier times of linkage and positional cloning. For the top genes in the Eve cohort, here are some of the odds ratios in each of the individual ethnicities and then combined. And so you can see that they confer modest risk, as would be expected from complex trait variants. And again, we see that the FIN1 polymorphism is really only strongly associated with asthma in African Americans and Afro-Caribbeans, but is not really associated in Latinos and is not present in the Caucasian populations. I've already spoken to you a little bit about the Gasdermin ORMDL3 locus, but I want to spend a few minutes talking about these next three loci because it's really an extraordinary story. And again, this is just what's falling out of the data. There's nothing forced or coerced here. So if we begin by talking about IL-33, there's a strong literature implicating this gene in allergic inflammation. Murine studies have shown that this gene mediates Th2 inflammation and increases peripheral eosinophilia and IgE levels in murine models. And in human studies, severe asthma cases show increased expression of this gene in both the bronchial epithelium and bronchial smooth muscle, and there seems to be a correlation between asthma severity and the level of expression of this gene. Importantly, one of the earlier GWAS studies that was done in the Iceland population also showed strong association of this variant with both eosinophilia and asthma. But the story gets more interesting when we look at the next gene on the list, IL-1 receptor-like 1, which happens to be the primary receptor for IL-33. So through this process that really doesn't necessarily need to identify genes that are related to each other, the two genes that are most intimately related to each other on the list are the ligand and its receptor, and both of them showing strong association with asthma in both sets of cohorts. And again here, this gene is expressed on many of the effector target cells of asthma, including the bronchial epithelium, smooth muscle, mast cells, basophils, and eosinophils. And inhibition of this gene seems to decrease and attenuate airways hyperresponsiveness in mouse models. And this gene also seems to be important in mediating influenza-based lung pathology, including airways responsiveness and reactivity. Again, in the Iceland population, which was not included in either the Gabriel or in the Eve meta-analyses, this gene was again identified both with asthma and with eosinophilia. Finally, the thymic stromal lymphoprotein on chromosome 5, or TSLP, is also a cytokine. It is expressed in bronchial epithelium. And without going through all of the data, it too seems to target the same gene, the same pathways as does the IL-33 pathway. It turns out that there's a cross-reactivity between the two. So this is nicely illustrated in a lengthy but really beautiful review of these pathways by Sings, Taylor, and Artis, where they show that both TSLP and IL-33 induce the NF-kappa B pathway. But nicely in this figure, they show that both of these genes and IL-25 all originate in their expression from lymphocytes, but as well from the epithelium itself. IL-33 increases TSLP expression, and all of these target the same set of cells and in the same direction, with an increase in Th2-based inflammation, with eosinophilia, airways responsiveness, and the like. So to us, these results were extremely exciting and really highlights to us the promise of these GWAS studies. So GWAS has been really great, but there are some things that remain problematic. And this is illustrated, one of the major ones is illustrated here on this slide. In the Gabriel study, they estimated what the predictive accuracy would be by using the best polymorphisms that came out of their study and see whether or not you could differentiate asthmatics from non-asthmatics. And the receiver operating curve statistics were pretty poor, 0.58, which is not much better than the 0.5 that you would get from flipping a coin. So when they then modeled how much of the total heritability, so how much of the genetic variability in the disease could be explained by the variants they identified, it was less than 5%. So something's going on here. And this has been characterized as the case of the missing heritability, illustrated best by this example of Crohn's. In a very large meta-analysis of tens of thousands of subjects with Crohn's disease, researchers identified more than 70 different genes. If we look at the amount of variability, the genetic variability explained by these variants, it doesn't even reach 25%. And that's after identifying 70 genes that are significantly reproducibly associated with Crohn's. If they went even further and took the best 20,000 variants from the GWAS study, they would only hit 50% of the variability. This has been seen in many other traits, including height, which is a very genetically determined condition trait, and it's not really clear what is causing this. But we think that there are a number of things that we can start addressing and investigating that might be underlying some of this heritability. So firstly, there are many variants that we have yet to test that are common, that are not properly represented on the chips that have been used for the GWAS studies. And so those are being addressed in a number of different ways. Another is the importance of regulatory variation of relatively weak effect that really would take very large cohorts to identify. Third are rare genetic variants of strong effect. GWAS studies are really powered to look at common variation. And of course, two things that have really not been addressed at all is the gene-by-gene interactions and the gene-by-environment interactions that are likely so important in all complex diseases, but particularly in asthma. So to very briefly illustrate what I'm talking about with respect to the rare variant problem, here is a plot of allele frequency spectrum versus the heritability explained by a given variant. So again, but what I mean by heritability is the amount of the genetic basis of the disease explained by the variation. When we think about monogenic traits, those are traits that are typically characterized by very rare mutations, but that have very high penetrance. If you have that mutation, it's very likely you have the disease, like cystic fibrosis. While common complex traits have a very different spectrum. We have a very broad range of allele frequencies, and I would say the majority are probably over here, not over here. And the relative heritability is low for each of them. And again, for many genes, it's probably down here. There really is nothing that sits up here with the exception of one trait. It's devastating. And that's the Y chromosome, which is seen in 50% of the population as has 100% penetrance and confers maleness. But aside from that, there is no other trait that really sits up there. Linkage analysis is very good at mapping rare variants of strong effect. GWAS studies do much better with common variants, and although there really is nothing up here in this world, they do pretty well in identifying any of the variants related to disease here. When we superimpose a number of different diseases, just as illustration, we see monogenic diseases, oligogenic diseases like BRCA1 for breast cancer, Crohn's disease, the first gene identified through GWAS was for age-related macular degeneration, and then ORMDL3 sitting down over here. And really all of the asthma genes identified to date really sit down here. The issue really becomes rare variants, which sit in this space and for which all of the techniques we currently use are underpowered. And it's likely that these play an important role. We don't know yet what the role is, but there's no reason to think that there aren't many rare variants that can impact disease. And so one of the ways that we're moving forward in this direction is to add in genome-wide sequencing. And we're quickly moving towards a $1,000 genome. The prices have recently dropped to about $4,000 to characterize all of the sequence variants across the entire genome. And that would get us resolution all the way down to the single base. The problem here is going to be the statistics. the statistical power, the number of subjects that we have to sequence, the sample size, study designs, whether they be family-based or population-based studies, all of that still is being worked out. But the hope is that with the introduction of these technologies, we'll be able to get closer to that part of the process. The second and really the last area that I want to focus on is this second problem in missing heritability of really recognizing the importance of regulatory variation. So there has really been a shift change in our understanding of what type of genetic variants underlie asthma and other complex diseases. This figure shows the relative proportion of non-coding variation or regulatory variation versus coding variation in monogenic diseases and in more complex diseases. So these statistics are generated from a database, in the case of the monogenic diseases, of all mutations characterized in rare monogenic diseases. And we can see from that the overwhelming majority of variation causing those diseases is coding. And this makes sense because I described earlier that these genes, these variants, have devastating impact. So in order to have a devastating impact on phenotype, they have to have a major structural change in the underlying proteins. On the other hand, when looking at the current database of all GWAS studies that have been done to date, the vast majority of the variants identified are not coding variants. They're regulatory. We're assuming that they're regulatory because they don't seem to be in linkage disequilibrium with anything that's coding in any of the nearby genes. And so we need methods to be able to identify these variants. One of the approaches that's being used, and this is something that I've been quite interested in, is EQTL mapping, or expression quantitative trait locus mapping. In a classical genetic study, we might test a regulatory variant to see if it's associated with disease. That's what we do. But in fact, there's a lot of noise in order to get from the variant to the disease process itself. First of all, that regulatory variant has to induce a change in expression of the gene. That, in turn, needs to result in a whole cascade of events, including protein synthesis, gene-gene interaction, transportation of the protein, and then its action in the context of environmental exposure. The person then comes to clinical attention, and that doctor might say, "You would be great for my genetic study." Because of all of these processes, which are all valid, getting a true understanding of the association between SNP and variant just on the basis of genetic studies alone may not be enough. What EQTL studies do are consider the first step in this process, the transcription of the target genes, as the trait of interest. And so we do a GWAS study and simultaneously do gene expression studies, measuring the transcript levels of the genes in the genome, and for each one of these genes, look to see if there's a correlation between SNP and the level of expression of the gene, much like what I showed you earlier for ORMDL3. And these variants, when identified, are called eSNP, expression SNPs. And the idea is that these SNPs should be enriched for disease associations. Well, in fact, that is the case. In two studies, one by our group and one by Dan Nicolai and Nancy Cox in Chicago, we both demonstrate that there's a very strong enrichment among disease-associated variants for these EQTLs, somewhere between a 1.5 to 2-fold increase. And importantly, we've recently seen that there's a 2-fold enrichment for asthma-associated variants when these EQTL studies are done in asthma-related cell types. And so here's one example of those. So up in this corner over here, we see a physical map of the position of several genes related to the FADS locus. So this is the fatty acid desaturase gene locus. There's FADS 1, FADS 2, and FADS 3. Plotted here is the negative log p-value of association of a whole series of SNPs that were tested for association with the expression of FADS 2. And we see a very strong association with polymorphisms, particularly in the promoter of the FADS 2 gene. Here is a haplotype-based analysis, and we see that there's one haplotype that's very strongly associated with high expression of FADS2, and another haplotype that's associated with very low expression. This FADS2 haplotype that increases expression is very strongly associated with asthma in our cohorts. Notice the p-value here. This association would not have been seen in our GWAS study alone because it wouldn't have met the stringency for multiple comparison testing. But because we have a much more limited number of tests that are performed, because we're only looking at those that are EQTL SNPs, this gene pops up. Well, it turns out that this variant, which is an intimate regulator of FADS2 expression, had already been studied, not in asthma, but in other atopic conditions. And it turns out that there's evidence of association with these variants with atopic dermatitis and allergic rhinitis. Very importantly, the FADS gene, FADS2, is the major metabolic determinant of shuttling linoleic acid and other fatty acids to the synthesis of eicosanoids, particularly arachidonic acid. And here below is not a Manhattan, it's a Manhattan plot, but really I would say this is a Seattle plot, because this is not the Manhattan skyline, this is the Seattle Space Needle. This is the association of a whole set of SNPs on this, in the same region, including the same asthma susceptibility variant, with arachidonic acid level in a GWAS study of arachidonic acid levels. And it turns out that this gene is the primary determinant of arachidonic acid levels in the general population. Moreover, there's a regulatory variant, the one that's most strongly associated with asthma in our cohorts, that differentially binds ELK1, changing the transcription of the FADS2 gene. And so from this, we can develop a model specifically for this variant that changing from the C to T at this promoter polymorphism increases L1 binding, which increases FADS2 expression, in turn increasing the production of arachidonic acid, the synthesis of various leukotrienes and prostaglandins, and we should suspect, we still need to determine that this is the case, that generates a pro-inflammatory profile conducive for the development of the disease. Of course, within this whole collection of genes, of products, there are many that are anti-inflammatory, and so there's a lot of work to be done before we know precisely where this goes. So with all that, I would say, where are we now? I've taken the same slide as before, but now superimposed the new genes that have been identified by GWAS. We can see a lot of promise from these studies. There's a lot more to do. Some of these candidates, some of the genes that have been identified have provided us with insights towards new therapies. One interesting area that we've been approaching in the lab is through identification of variants in the vitamin D receptor that were strongly associated with asthma in multiple polymorphisms. Others in our group, including Gus LaTonya, have looked at the relationship of vitamin D levels, vitamin D insufficiency in the development of asthma, and has indeed found very strong relationships between vitamin D insufficiency in mothers and the subsequent development of asthma in children. And so there's now a prospective clinical trial underway to determine whether supplementation would improve that. So again, another way in which genetics can inform downstream therapeutics. So where are we going? So I've taken you from the early days of linkage through the genomic phase of genome-wide association studies, and where we're currently going is towards next-generation sequencing. I think in the area of music, it's really, really hard to predict. But I think in politics, we all know exactly where we're going. It's going to be Bieber and Gaga. I think that's the 2020 ticket. Maybe 2024, because that's when my daughter would be able to vote, and she would definitely vote for both of them. But in terms of genetic and genomic science, I think it's going to be equally crazy, because we're moving towards systems genomics and looking at these gene-gene interactions and looking at how genes work in the context of each other and with the environment. And really, I see a number of different areas where things are moving. I've shown you where all of the studies have been done in GWAS studies. There's one in Japan that's embedded here, and there's another one in Iceland that I had mentioned earlier. But there's a huge part of the world that does have an asthma prevalence that has not been studied appropriately. And even the Latino and African populations in the United States that have been studied, those studies have been underpowered. So there's a lot more GWAS and resequencing that's going to need to be done, particularly in those populations. The gene-by-environment interactions are important. The systems-based approaches are important. Functional understanding of the variants we identify is certainly a new avenue that we're pursuing with many of these genes. And we hope to move towards clinical applications. And although I don't have the time to spend talking about pharmacogenetics more in more detail, We do know that there is very strong interindividual variability in response to pharmacologic therapies in asthma. And here are a number of studies by members of the Partners Asthma Center, including Kellen Tantasira, Elliot Israel studies, and Mike Wexler's studies, looking at inhaled corticosteroid pharmacogenetics and beta-adrenergic response. And there are many other studies like this that have been published and are being published. These were candidate gene studies in pharmacogenetics, and now we've moved towards a more GWAS-based approach for pharmacogenetics, and we're starting to see some really interesting results from those as well. So with that, I just want to conclude with some thoughts on perspective and patients. I mentioned at the beginning of the talk that there are really two goals of asthma genetics. One is to identify the genes that cause the disease so that we can develop new therapies, and the other is to identify the variants that cause the disease so that we can develop predictive models, both for pharmacogenetics and other. And I would say that we've had really good successes on the first side of the equation and much less so on the second. And a lot of people debate in general whether or not people should really turn off their phones during these talks. Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Very good, very good. So, you know, people in general have, some critics of GWAS and genetics in general have claimed that, you know, if you look at, for example, cystic fibrosis, which was cloned in the gene was cloned in 1989, we still don't yet have a treatment for cystic fibrosis that's based on those genetic insights. And so maybe the value of this investment in genetics is not so appropriate. Well, for some perspective, I'd like to first show you this historical trajectory. Back in the 1600s, Andreas Vesalius and William Harvey characterized the anatomy and the physiology of the cardiovascular system. But it took 400 years before we had heart surgeries. And the reasons for that were somewhat technological. We needed to develop anesthesia and sterile techniques and so on. Some of it was cultural. That, in fact, one of the reasons why it took so long to properly understand the anatomy was that people were barred from performing dissections. It was the work that Andreas Vesalius did was illegal at the time. Well, it took 400 years to get that far with anatomy and physiology. Back at the time when anesthesia was discovered, Gregor Mendel proposed the theory of heritability and the laws of Mendelian inheritance. It took 100 years to characterize the anatomy of DNA, of the heritable material, and it then only took another 30 years from there to identify the CFTR mutations that underlie cystic fibrosis. Not bad. But what about since then? If we look at what's happened subsequent to the cloning of the cystic fibrosis gene, that event, along with several other successes, prompted the huge investment in the Genome Project. And within less than 10 years, we had a significantly completed sequence of the entire human genome. And the first genome-wide association study was performed only a few years after that, and now here we are. This is now almost 3,000 Mendelian diseases have been mapped, and 1,400 mutations or variants in complex traits have been mapped. But look at similarly what's going on in heart disease. We're starting to develop a whole series of therapies that are based on this genomic revolution. But it takes time. And I'll leave you with this, that although it's true we don't have a cure for cystic fibrosis yet, if we look at what the average life expectancy was for cystic fibrosis back in 1989, it was 24 years. Whereas today, the average life expectancy is much, much longer. And that is attributable not entirely to genetics, but largely due to the ability to identify affected individuals through genetic testing in a preclinical stage, and then offer them preventative strategies and prophylaxis very early on. And so although this isn't curative, we certainly can even see what the impact has been on genetics, on cystic fibrosis. And with that, I would say that I think we're not yet anywhere near that with asthma, but I think we'll get there much faster than we think. And so with that, I just want to thank everyone, particularly the people who have fostered my career over the last 10 years, and all of my colleagues, both here and abroad, and to all of you for your wonderful attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
a terrific insight into asthma genomics and a look into the future as well. Can we take questions here from our audience first? Dr. Drazen.
So Benji, we do know about some asthma genes, and what I haven't seen yet are people taking the genes that we know in large asthma populations to see if you can distinguish characteristics of people that have one genotype versus people that have another, to try to use the information that we have in hand rather than asking what have an effect in asthma. The question is, when we know about a gene, does it have an impact on the phenotype? So why has that not happened?
Yeah, so the question has to do with, though we've started to identify many genes that are associated with the condition of asthma, there has not yet been many studies that have looked at what type of phenotypic correlation there is with the variants that are identified. Is there a particular type of asthma or manifestation of the asthma that is manifest by a particular variant? And so I think that there's a few reasons why those studies haven't been done, but I would agree that those studies need to be done. They haven't been done with much success, largely because of the very large sample sizes that one would need, and those samples would have to be exquisitely characterized. So very often in genetic studies, we want to maximize our sample size, but in order to do that from an economic point of view, where there's a trade-off in the type of phenotypic information that's collected. For the type of studies that are needed to really do accurate genotype-phenotype correlations in complex traits, you need large populations that are really well phenotyped. The smaller types of studies that have been done may be of some merit. So I mentioned earlier the case of the ORMDL3 story, where it appears as though it might confer an earlier onset and a non-atopic-like phenotype. And there's some other studies that have been done like that, but the reproducibility of those findings is not there yet. And that might be due to sample size issues or other technical issues. But what's going to be needed is more of these large-scale consortia-like efforts where we do exquisite phenotyping on already ascertained individuals and on new cohorts and really get to this question. Because I think at the end of the day, if we really want to move towards personalized medicine, it's not only the pharmacogenetic aspect of things, it's also understanding the different clinical phenotypes.
Can we try and see if we could take a question from our colleagues at the Cox Conference Room at the Mass General with your... do you have any questions for us? Hi. No.
Oh, at least you know he's alive.
They both moved. Thanks for joining us. Any other questions here in the Borenstein? I had one little one about the cultural. You mentioned about the cultural barriers and the thinking about genome-wide sequencing, which I take to mean pretty well knowing all of my genes and how they may differ from someone else. Will there be barriers in terms of recruiting subjects who may object to having all of their genetic information studied in that way?
Absolutely. So just to repeat the question, some of the cultural barriers, one of them being the issue of consent to do genetic testing, and is there thought that there's going to be particular difficulty with doing genome-wide sequencing, given that we'll have all of the variants at our disposal. So there's no question that there are cultural differences in willingness to participate in genetic studies. And this has been the case dating back to the days of linkage. And so, you know, even studies that are ongoing now at the Partners Asthma Center, it's been very difficult to recruit people of minority populations, specifically due to some of the fears related to genetic persecution alike. Fortunately, there are a number of laws that are on the books at the federal level that should protect human subjects from genetic discrimination, even if the materials were to be disclosed in some way. And all of the consenting processes have to include a protocol with rigorous protection of that data so that it's not disclosed inadvertently. But having said that, people are still scared. And one of the concerns that we would have is that there would be a bias in terms of who we're studying, and that we might have a very difficult time making conclusions about how to best treat people of the ethnicities that are not well represented.
And just the flip side, can you envision a day when people would say, I'd like to know my genome. I don't have $1,000 to pay, but can I get in part of a study? Because I'd like to have this information to share with my physician.
Right. So certainly people are already getting their genome sequenced. It's still costly, so it's only the affluent right now who are really getting this done. But more and more people would be curious in having that. One of the problems is that we're not allowed to disclose under the current protocols, we're not allowed to disclose the genotypic information back to the study participants. It's not CLIA certified data. The relevance of it is not clear. There's all kinds of implications because it's a heritable material. What you know about your genome has implications on other people. And so we right now there's barriers to that. But people are curious, and the truth is that people wonder if whether or not this is going to become a reality. As the price drops, it's going to become a reality. So right now, the diagnostic panel for mutations that cause, for example, hypertrophic cardiomyopathies, those panels cost a few thousand dollars. Imagine if you can get the whole sequence of the genome for less than $1,000 for every condition. So we know that we're moving towards getting that technology in place because the cost of it's going to be amortized off of every condition you can imagine. So there will be a whole series of ramifications and a changing in our understanding of the potential for discrimination and abuse of this information, and that'll happen sooner rather than later.
All right. Thank you very much. That was great. Terrific. Thanks great. So much.